Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Fifth episode of The Great Scientist. I'm just reading through this book. Last night, at the end of the fourth episode, the sun went down and I ran out of light. It's interesting now that you think about it. The sun's over there and it's now facing towards me. Okay, we were doing the last bit of Anton Lavoisier. I'm just going to finish that because it's worth thinking about. So, phlogiston is a substance thought up by an alchemist to be in an object, and when it comes out of an object, it comes out as fire. It's interesting that flame, as we know it, is the heat from the flame radiates into the solid object. The solid object acquires temperature. That object emits gaseous fuel. So it's, the flame is a gas, obviously, and it goes up into the flame region where free radicals inside the flame attack the fuel and break it down. So you've got a, for a flame, you've got a region of free radicals and high temperature, which allows the process of fuel to react with the oxygen. So the fuel and oxygen don't burn until it actually gets into the flame region. So I thought I'd tell you that. The phlogiston debate was quite literally the burning scientific question of the 18th century. It was the focus of the battle of between the ideas which owed much to alchemy and the new science of chemistry, in particular the idea of elements. The alchemists still believed in the same four basic elements as the ancient Greeks, air, water, fire, earth, while the chemists learned instead the ideas of Robert Boyle. Boyle has suggested the idea of chemical evidence, elements, that everything is made of a handful of basic substances or elements, each system tied up of elementary corpuscles. If Boyle was right, the elements could only be mixed together, not changed. The idea of four elements might have to be abandoned. The debate between alchemists and the chemists became the centre of the phlogiston theory, which said anything burnable contained a special active substance called phlogiston that dissolved in air when it burned. Therefore, anything that burned must become lighter because it loses phlogiston. At first, this theory seemed to sound to everybody and had become established scientific orthodoxy. Later, it began to be challenged. It was Lavoisier who realized that the way to test the true was to weigh substances carefully before and after burning. In his famous brilliant experiment, he burned a piece of tin inside a sealed container. He found that, contrary to phlogiston theory, the tin actually became heavier after burning, while the air became lighter. There was no change to the mass at all, as the substances were simply changing places. Okay. Where is it the same? Everything got the air. It was also clear that rather than losing something, phlogiston, to the air, the tin was taking something in. Later, Lavoisier realized that something in gas must be called oxygen. Lavoisier's experiment was a turning point in our understanding of matter for three reasons. Firstly, it put the accurate scientific measurement firmly at the heart of chemistry. Secondly, it demolished the phlogiston theory and showed the burning process involving oxygen. Thirdly, it showed substances do not change or vanish even if dramatic process of burning. They simply swap places. Isn't that absolutely beautiful to put in poor Lavoisier? Now, it's interesting, he's a lawyer. So it's the idea that nature should be accountable. So it's interesting that for all this, the legal mind had to come in organise things. Okay, we're on to John Dalton, 1766 to 1844, a mild-mannered chemist who sometimes said to be the father of chemistry. John Dalton, which is also Lavoisier's father of chemistry, 1766 to 1844, established the modern theory of atoms and elements. So he must be, each of those are a factor of 11. 66 is 44, and 44 is 88 when he died. Is that right? No, 34, and it's 78 when he died. So paved the way for the huge range of scientific achievements. The idea of atoms was by no means new in the 18th century. In fact, it had been around for well over 2,000 years. For instance, Greek thinker Aristotle, 384 to 322 BC, thought the theory of matter could be chopped into smaller and smaller pieces, but other Greeks, notably Democritus, 640 to 400 BC, which is obviously before him, argued that matter was really made of tiny particles with empty space in between. Just as scientists believe today, well, we know we actually don't believe that. That just makes me so angry. We believe in quantum physics, in which an atom, each atom really inhabits the entire universe. Each atom is soft and full. There's no empty space in between. I just hate that so much. But you know, I suppose gas is a reasonable. These particles were the smallest possible pieces of matter, which Democritus called atoms from the Greek ankatol. People struggled to imagine how air and water could be made of tiny particles, and although the idea of atoms was not forgotten, Aristotle's view found to be more convincing. In addition, Aristotle's view of the world is made from just the four main elements, earth, fire, water, and air, also proved convincing. Even now, scientists believe matter exists in four phases, solid, gas, and plasma. Again, that's just so frustrating. It's, you know, you have to talk about the significant phases in terms of entropy or fundamental property. So, although you might say the sun's completely a plasma, there is a gaseous plasma layer and a solid plasma layer beneath the troposphere. And then you've got crystals and glasses. I just find it so frustrating to read this. Then, in the 17th century, scientists began to question Aristotle's view of matter. The Irish scientist Robert Boyle, 1672-91, suggested there was other kinds of elements, basic pure substances, that could combine to make compounds. Crucially, he suggested that each of these chemical elements had its own unique characteristics, and each could exist as a solid, liquid, or gas. Boyle even suggested that matter might consist of atoms after all. The Aristotelian view of matter was further undermined by experiments began to reveal that neither air nor water were indivisible elements. First of all, scientists such as Joseph Priestley and Antoine Lavoisier showed the air was a mixture of two gases containing oxygen and nitrogen. Then Lavoisier showed water too was a compound of oxygen and hydrogen. Lavoisier even made a list of a dozen basic chemical elements, including the newly discovered components of air and water. After 2,000 years, the atomic idea was finally beginning to gain credence. Yet for all this progress, no one knew just what an element was, and no one had thought to connect them with atoms in any way. It was assumed, for instance, that if matter, including air, was made of atoms, all atoms must be identical. It was John Dalton's great insight to see that atoms of each gas's air might be different. That's just really hurting my head. As a quantum physicist, that's hurting my head. He went further to unify all the progress of the previous century of the atomic theory of elements, which underpins the science today. Dalton suggested that all atoms in an element were identical. Insight to say that atoms of each of the gases in the air might be different. Oh, the atom itself was different. Okay, I might get that one. Dalton suggested that all the elements were identical but different from every other element. He also argued that the compounds were formed by joining of an atom of one element to an atom of another. Although theories of elements and compounds had developed since Dalton's time, the essentials of his ideas are still there. Childhood in the Lakes. John Dalton was born on the 6th of December 1766. That's when the Great Fire, 100 years after the Great Fire, in the English Lake District coastal town of Cockermouth, and to a family of Quaker tradesmen. Now, it's really interesting that the Quakers, Priestley was a cult. These people are all non-standard. They're of extreme Christian cults. Faraday was a cult person. As a boy, he was alert and inquisitive rather than a brilliant scholar, but he was bright enough to be appointed to a teacher at the local school at the age of 12, and the Quaker relative Eli Robinson tutored him in science. In 1781, at the age of 15, you must understand that if you wanted to be a religious sect, you were just cut out, completely out of English society. okay, everyone had to be Church of England, and there was all this racism. So this actually sort of fragmented society and minimalized it. While he was there, he was tutored in mathematics and natural sciences by the remarkable blind philosopher John Gough, who is described by poet William Wordsworth in his poem The Excursion. "Methinks I see him now, his eyeballs roll beneath his ample brow." Encouraged by Gough, and often awe-inspiring by the Lake District weather, Dalton began to make meteorological observations. The weatherman, over the next 15 years, Dalton made a weather diary which recorded over 200,000 observations. His interest in weather is a lifelong and profound, and his insights are groundbreaking. Indeed, some people believe he ought to be called the father of meteorology, rather, as well as the father of chemistry. It's interesting, the observations there. It's also an interesting point that creating a mainstream, one of the things of creating a mainstream, it creates these fragmentary external bodies, which doesn't. Dalton always was wary and trusty of other people's ideas and insisted that he would believe only what he had observed himself. Quote, "Having been in my progress so often misled by the talk, taking for granted the results of others," he wrote, quote, "I am determined to write as little as possible, but I can attest my own experience." He was not particularly a particularly accurate observer nor a brilliant experimental science. But his scepticism, plus a remarkable capacity for insight overview, enabled him to make the most of his work. Over the years, he wrote important papers on the barometer, thermometer, hygrometer, rainfall, formation of clouds, evaporation, movement of atmospheric moisture, and much more. Dalton was the first to realize atmospheric moisture turns to rainfall, not as a result of pressure changes, but because reduction in temperature reducing the air's capacity to hold water and vapor. In 1788, after witnessing a spectacular display of the aurora borealis and northern lights, he came to a remarkably precedent conclusion that the auroras were caused by the Earth's magnetism. Dalton's unaware of George Hadley had been suggesting the same thing. He even came to the quick conclusion that the trade winds were caused by the combination of regional temperature variations in the Earth's rotation. Colour blindness, now Daltonism. Besides his meteorological studies, Dalton also became fascinated by the condition that he and his brother shared, colour blindness. Dalton was the first to study colour blindness scientifically, and with the condition is still sometimes known as Daltonism. Colour blindness was the subject of his first paper entitled Extraordinary Facts Relating to the Vision of Colours, which he presented when he was elected to the Manchester Library and Philosophical Society, 1791. It's interesting, Manchester is such a major player, yet no one really knows about it. London outshines it. Dalton asked that when he died, his eyes would be examined to discover the reason for his colour blindness, because he believed the fault could not be the fluid of his eyes. It was blue. Postmortem showed the fluid was entirely normal, but in 1990s, the DNA tested on his eyes, which had been preserved in the Royal Institution for 150 years, showed the lack of pigment needed to give sensitivity to green. A world of particles. Dalton contributed hundreds of more papers to the Manchester Society, and in 1817 was elected the president, a post he held for the rest of his life. Perhaps the most important of these papers were presented in the early 1800s. By that time, Dalton had given up full-time teaching and was funding his scientific studies through private tutoring of sons and daughters of Manchester's rising middle class. It's amazing, this. The extra time he gave him enabled him to produce a series of papers in which he developed the atomic theory of matter. He argued the elements then known to be hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, made up of atoms, is solid and mass, the hard and impenetrable, immovable particles. It was a key insight the chemists had been looking for, the understanding of just what elements were and why they combined as they did. The implications of the theory were accepted surprisingly rapidly and quickly became the focus of most chemical research. The unworldly hero. Dalton's work as a teacher had already made him much loved. He was establishment of atomic theory, and his scientific reputation came immense. Yet he remained a solitary man, never married, rarely socializing and living a life of recluse. His time was dedicated to his pupils, his scientific research. Throughout his life, his needs were simple, his habits plain, and he always dressed a plain Quaker style. In 1810, his scientific achievements were recognized by invitation to join the Royal Society. Diffident and short of money, Dalton declined the offer. But then, in 1822, the Royal Society elected him a member and paid for his election for him. Professor Committee of Science made him their sole permitted foreign member. Dutton lived out his last years quietly. His scientific research began to look rather introverted as his doctoral independence, he refused to acknowledge the advances made in science. The valuable connections to his ideas in the years since have been announced since he announced his atomic theory. Nonetheless, the respect for inspection for in which he was held because he became clear when he died of a stroke at the age of 78. Tribute support in for the Manchester Society and people in Manchester gave him what can only be called a state funeral attended by 40,000 mourners. I think my dad, who's the inventor of computer music and sort of science, between 4,000 and 6,000 mourners at this church. Okay, Dalton's atomic theory. The earliest papers which Dalton developed his atomic theory concerned the studies of air pressure and the way it affected how much water is absorbed. Contrary to the prevailing view of the day, Dalton was convinced the air was a mixture of different gases, not a compound of them like water. In his experiments, he observed pure oxygen will not absorb as much water as pure nitrogen, and jumped to the remarkable intuitive conclusion that it is because oxygen atoms were bigger and heavier than nitrogen atoms. Well, I don't know if that's true. It's just that water sticks to nitrogen more. That oxygen has its nitrogen. I don't know. I find it really hard to understand, to think that one through. Water does not emit the bulk of every kind of gas alike. Dalton wrote, the question I have duly considered and thought I am not able to satisfy completely. I nearly persuaded that the circumference depends on the weight and the number of ultimate particles of the several gases. That would be really interesting, that if the water vapor actually indicated the actual something simple like just the van der Waals radius of the atom. In a paper of the Manchester Society on the 25th of October 1803, Dalton went further, saying, quote, an inquiry to the relative weight of the ultimate particles of bodies is a subject, as far as I know, entirely new. I have lately been prosecuting the inquiry with remarkable success. He went on to describe how he had arrived at different weights for basic units of each elemental gas, in other words, the weight of their atoms, or atomic weight. That is true, that a litre of atmospheric gas is in proportion to the molecular weight. So a litre of nitrogen box, with no atmospheric pressure, and a litre of oxygen, a litre of xenon, and a litre of all these things will weigh different amounts. He went on to argue that atoms of each element combined to make a compound of simple ratios, and to weigh each atom would be worked out with the weight of each element involved in the compound, the idea which later became called the law of multiple proportions. Hydrogen, Dalton realized, was the lightest gas, and so he assigned it the atomic weight 1. Because the weight of the oxygen is combined with the water, he assigned the atomic weight number 7. And oxygen 14, atomic weight says 2. There was a basic law in Dalton's method, because he did not realize atoms of the same element can combine. He always assumed that atoms, a compound of atoms, a molecule, only had one of each element. It was another half century before scientists realized that only the Italian scientist Amedeo Avogadro's idea of using molecular proportions to allow them to calculate atomic weights correctly. I've got to do Avogadro's number. So it's 602 by 10 to the 23, I think. I just have to get that mentally in my head. Nemeth is the basic idea of Dalton's atomic theory, in that each element had its own unique sized atoms, has proved resoundingly true. Scientists have played down Dalton's role, suggesting his scientific research was less than solid, and that his atomic theory was built on the work of others. However, there is no doubt that Dalton, who brought it all together in the mainstream science, and there is no doubting the importance of the atomic theory into science. The biographer Frank Greenway says, with Dalton's theory, quote, we have made new materials, utilized new sources of energy, defeated one disease after another, and come to this, within sight of the mechanism of life. Yeah, it really is an aperiodic crystal. Okay, we're up into the next 18th century, which is Michael Faraday, one of my absolute favourite scientists. He's just beautiful. Michael Faraday, 1791 to 1867. So he actually died, I feel, rather young, my feeling. Was not merely a great experimental scientist, perhaps the greatest of all time, but the visionary theorist who realized that all forces of nature are interconnected. Faraday gave us both electric motor and the electric generator, paving the way for both electrical revolution. I don't think he was a theorist by any stretch of the imagination. When Michael Faraday was born in 1791, electricity was a hot topic in fashionable society. That is, I do know that we were going to electrocution parlors. Scientists and showmen of the day were able to create dramatic sparks by turning wheels and rubbing glass and sulfur against sulfur to generate static electricity. The Italian autonomous Galvani was using electricity to make the legs of dead frogs twitch. Galvani believed that he discovered the very force of life and all electricity and animated flesh and bones. Some dozens of scientists were trying to bring the corpses back to life by electrifying them, as sectors were all captured in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. The idea of electricity as a life force gained a powerful hold on the public imagination and inspired a host of fanatical scientists, including Andrew Ure, who, in a gruesome display in 1818, made a corpse of executed Glasgow murderer Matthew Clydesdale dance like a fucker. Another scientist, like Andrew Cross, in 1836, claimed to have created insects called Ascari with electricity. With all this electrical hysteria was going on, rapid and serious advances were being made by experimental scientists towards the understanding of the true nature of electricity. Late in 1790, for instance, Alcestro Volta realized that electricity can be created by chemical reaction and used the idea to create the first battery in 1800. Now, the interesting thing is he had a power, but he didn't really understand that he had a salt. His cheese cloth soaked with salt was inside, and that hydrogen was being given off and his skin would decay. So he didn't really understand the full chemical reaction, which is, goes today. Using Volta's battery or trough to give them a supply of electricity on tap, various scientists discovered electricity could flow through a complete loop of circuit. Otto Ampe also learned about the strength of currents, and George Ohm discovered the nature of electrical resistance. Then, in 1820, Danish scientist Hans Oersted discovered the electric current cord make a needle of the magnetic compass swivel. Now, he was investigating Kant's beliefs. It was the first inkling of the link between the natural forces that immediately became the focus of experimentation among scientists. Faraday was just one among many who had tried their hand at unlocking the secrets of electricity and magnetism in the 1820s and 1830s. His extraordinary inventive meticulous experimental work and his keen theoretical insight, however, put him at the forefront of all key breakthroughs. I think that's complete rubbish, having read his thing. I think he was gifted, but he was fed the major ideas by Davy. Okay. Within a few months of hearing Oersted's discovery, Faraday had constructed an ingenious demonstration that showed how a magnetic would move in a circle around an electric wire, and the electric wire would move in a circle around a magnet. He had discovered the principle of the electric motor. Well, that's totally incorrect. He went with Davy to Ampere, and Davy suggested he make this experiment. This is just the worst I've ever read. 10 years later, Faraday made an even more important discovery. Moving a magnet can create induced current of electricity. The principle is called the principle of electric magnetic induction. and which was discovered independently by Joseph Henry in America around the same time, meant that the machines could be built to generate quantities of electricity, opening away from everything from electric lighting to telecommunications. Yet neither the electric motor nor the principle of electric induction are perhaps Faraday's greatest achievements. He went on not just to demonstrate the principle of electrolysis, the way chemicals broke down by electricity, but to demonstrate the ultimate unity between all forces, including electricity, magnetism, light, and even gravity. That's just appalling. And to develop the idea of field forces. This is a crucial insight that paved the way for all modern physics and a host of modern technologies, from television to mobile phones. Well, field forces is like the worst high school science. So Faraday was, in fact, deeply religious and is of some ceremony. He was a preacher, and he used to make copper plates, and he would do the lines coming out of the force of God, and he would use those lines to demonstrate. And it turns out that field forces are complete bollocks. Gee, okay. Hello, darling. Poor boy. When Faraday was born, just check what the time is. Science is very much in a province of the rich, which is the main important. Not only was money needed to construct experiments, but connections were also required to get to the scientific establishment. Yet Faraday was a child of poor parents, and his story was presented as a rag-to-riches tale. He was never rich. The Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, saw him as the archetypal self-made man triumphing over his poor background. Oh, this is just complete misinterpretation. Faraday was brought up in a poor district of London, the Elephant and Castle. His father was a blacksmith, but so disabled that he was barely able to support his family. Faraday recalled that they often only had bread to eat for weeks at a time. He considered himself lucky, therefore, to be taken as an apprentice at boy George Riblow's bookshop at Blandford Street at the age of 13. At the bookshop, he did just run engines, but began to learn how to bind books and began to read them avidly, especially those about science. In early life, he later read, "I was a very lively, imaginative person and would believe in Arabian Nights as easily as the encyclopedia. But facts were important to me and saved me. I could trust a fact." He became fascinated by science and helped his employer allow him to set up his own makeshift laboratory and in the book bindery. Magician's Apprentice. In the stroke of good fortune, William Dance, one of Riblow's customers, was a member of the Royal Institution, the premier scientific establishment of the day. Hearing the young Faraday's interest in science, Dance gave Faraday tickets to the celebrated demonstration of the institution to the famous scientist Humphrey Davies. Well, there you go. That's a piece of information I didn't know. The rest of this is complete bollocks. It's just the people themselves writing it have got a very poor understanding of science. In the chance of a lifetime, the poor boy, he took it with both hands. Faraday took avid notes of the lectures and drew them out meticulously with illustrations and sent a bound copy to Davy himself. Okay, this is before he did everything like this. Suitably impressed. Oh, this is not true. Davy ignored him. It's just only when he was blinded they found a book of his notes and found him. Davy took Faraday on at 21 as his assistant to the institution. What people will say is that this is incorrect, but it's good enough for students, and it's good enough to keep them like lies are good enough for dumb people. His assistants. When Davy was sent on tour Europe following year, he took Faraday with him, introducing to many of the world's leading scientists, including Ampere, Voltaire, and Gay-Lussac. What I should say is that he was Lady Jane married him because Davy was going to be made Sir Humphrey Davy, and you had to marry someone before they did to actually keep the ladyship. If you married someone afterwards when the person died, you lost the ladyship. That's the way ship. So Lady Jane had heaps of money. And he went on the honeymoon, and Faraday was kicked out of the carriage and had to go to Paris in the driving rain, sitting on top. Really interesting, a whole lot of stories there. Far from being self-taught, Faraday was getting his scientific education at the hands of the greatest mind of the age, and it paid off. Within a few years, he was not just helping David with his experiment, but actually conducting his own. This is just bollocks. In 1821, the Royal Institution, in the wake of Oersted's discovery, asked Faraday to compile a survey of current research on electricity. Faraday not only did this with his own characteristic meticulous insight, but tried his own experiments, including the first demonstration of the principle of the electric motor. This is also incorrect. Davy was said to have been upset that his apprentice gave him no credit for this, since he had been working on the same problem himself, and some historians still rankled enough for him to vote against Faraday when he was invited to join the Royal Society, though it may be Davy was simply seeing through his declared stance against despotism. Well, that's interesting at certain things, but I think he was a northerner. There was a whole heap of things. I wish they would actually do, like, Faraday is the first scientist. The word scientist was invented, the great scientist. He is the person that they invented the word scientist from, present we all. It's amazing they don't have this in here. Faraday, the present, and this is typical of these books, these people just get full of themselves, that they think they know everything and just go ahead. Faraday the presenter. Faraday was clearly aware of the need to present his discovery to society, and so hired as a renowned teacher in public speaking, Benjamin Smart, to teach him how to present well to an audience. In 1826 he began the famous series of public lectures which he called Friday Evening Discoveries. No, I think it's because he realised he had no theoretical insight. Maxwell's and good friends of him said that, look, you just can't do science. And so he said, well, I'm just going to teach instead. He prepared these meticulously with wonderfully effective demonstrations, experiments, and became immensely popular, especially amongst the fashionable sets. In the most spectacular of these, he placed himself inside a steel cage while genetic electrical sparks were shot from the outside. He knew that the shape of the cage would protect him, but it was nonetheless a stunning display. You know, the Faraday cage. Well, I didn't know that he himself went in the cage. I don't know if that is true. Even more successful were his Christmas lectures for children, in the tradition still practiced by the institution. In the famous Faraday's Christmas lecture series, it was called Chemical Histories of the Candle, in which he used candles to introduce a wealth of scientific ideas from chemical elements to human respirations. There is no better, he said. There is no more open door by which you can enter the study of natural philosophy than by considering the physical phenomenon of a candle. By 1830s, Faraday had become firmly established in the Royal Institution. His laboratory was in a basement. He was lectured in the public ground and was the first floor. And he lived with his loving wife, Sarah, in the flat upstairs. No, he was basically the go-get experimentalist society, and they were embarrassed by him, and I think Queen Victoria gave him a income, reaching the peaks. By the time Faraday reached the age of 50, he was beginning to suffer frequent headaches and occasional memory loss. He was still immensely fit and able to complete 73-kilometre walks over the Alps in little more than 10 hours, but he was more keen of what he was called head rest. Nevertheless, but he was in more and more need of what is called headrest. Nevertheless, this was the time of some of his greatest achievements. In 1745, Faraday began a series of experiments in which he tried to find out electricism could affect the way light polarized by transparent substances, the Faraday effect. This is absolutely rigorously interesting. Experimenting with any substance, he finally tried a piece of heavy lead glass, and at once found the polarizations affected by magnetism. It was an extraordinary achievement, showing a clear link between magnetism and electricity for the first time, which opened the way to discovery of the complete spectrum of the electromagnetic radiation, including television waves, microwaves, X-rays, and gamma rays, as well as light. No, but it's the Faraday effect is absolutely amazing. I didn't know it was just lead glass. We use Faraday rotators. Yes, honey? Do you want me to take Cecilia?
What?
Do you want me to take Cecilia?
I'm going to take Cecilia and go straight to street, so you better be ready. I've got your drink bottle.
Okay.
We need to have gone to the toilet or whatever.
Starting up podcasting again after a break there. Again on Michael Faraday, we just came to the attention that he did the Faraday effect, as it's called. This is where you put a magnetic field through a crystal, and the crystal then rotates the polarization with regard to the prevalent magnetic field in it. Now, the interesting thing is that it's not in time reversal, so it rotates clockwise going forward and then clockwise again going backwards, and therefore you can create things like circulators with Faraday rotators. Very interesting. It's very unclear how this person really is out of their depth when they're doing this. It was about this time Faraday began to talk about fields of force. The word field actually comes from William Thomson, a young Glasgow mathematician who, until the brilliant James Clerk Maxwell came along, felt was the only person in the world who fully understood his ideas. But the idea of field was all Faraday's, and the idea of field, goes into tensor, a space, a field, we talk about it, but it turns out that that Maxwell said his ideas were stupid to him. Okay, we'll have to read it a little bit later. The final years, I don't know if we're going to do this, I think we're back home already. Okay, I'll have to start a game. Okay, picking up after that interruption, it was a welcome introduction. It's about Faraday's last years, and he obviously had some cognitive decline, similar to my stuff, in terms of cognitive stuff, where you have to really work. And I'll read it here. It's called The Final Years. Throughout the 1840s, Faraday kept more and more to himself. This was partly because of his religion. He was an ardent member of a small Sandeman sect, which was so strict about religious observance that they apparently suspended Faraday as an elder when he missed Sunday in order to accept an invitation from the Queen. Interestingly, his religion meant that he could not accept all the honours he was offered, including the knighthood. People joked, not so much a far a day as a nearer night. A quiet life was also imposed on him by a struggle against mental frailty. He relied increasingly on his wife to be his pillow for my mind. He had ever more frequent dizzy spells, headaches, and memory loss. So this would be small strokes, probably due to heart conditions like myself. In 1826, he wrote in his friend Shorben, "Again, again, I tear out my letters, for I write nonsense. I cannot spell or write a line continuously. Whether I shall recover from this confusion, I do not know. I will not write any more." Faraday was given a grace and favour residence in Hampton Court Palace by the Queen and died there on the 25th of August 1967, at the age of 76. He is buried in Highgate Cemetery in London. Forces of nature. Now, one has to understand that at school they're taught what Faraday taught, even though it was proven to be nonsense. And you know what can you do? Teachers were taught by the teachers. At what point they go back? Well, surely Faraday wasn't teaching nonsense. Well, indeed he was. Let's listen to this. Forces of nature. Newton had with his concept of gravitation made a respectable idea of the invisible force that exerted effect through empty space. But the idea of action at a distance was beginning to look shaky to an increasing number of scientists in the early 19th century. By 1830, Thomas Young and August Fresnel had shown light does not travel as particles, as Newton said, but as waves or vibrations. But if this is so, what was vibrating? Well, I can tell you what's vibrating, the actual space itself. Space has a capacitance and inductance. This is so stupid. To answer this question, it's going up with the idea of weightless matter called ether. It should be actually spelled A-ether, A-E-T-H-E-R. Faraday had another idea. He came to believe in the idea of fields, field lines of force, lines that force demonstrated so graphically by patterns of iron filings around a magnet. Oh, that is just... Oh, don't get me started. That's so stupid. This means that the action at a distance certainly did not happen, but things moved and when they encountered these lines of force, which were not imaginary but physical reality. Well, Faraday thought they were physical reality when he was proven they're not, and he just gave in. Faraday appreciated magnets induced currents by creating moving lines of magnetic force that carried an electrical charge as they moved. That is actually complete bollocks. So there's a Faraday's paradox, which eventually he looked at, and it just... The idea of lines of field force is almost taken for granted. What? But in Faraday's time, oh, God, that makes me so incensed. But in Faraday's time, it was so radical that even very few even understood it, let alone agreed with it. They could see the idea of areas of magnetic influence, but the idea of electromagnetic field was completely beyond them. Mathematicians dismissed Faraday's idea for the lack of mathematics. In 55, Faraday wrote, quote, "How few understand the physical lines of force. They will not see them, yet their researchers on the subject seem to confirm the views I put forth many years since. I am content to wait, convinced that as my truth in my views." And he was right. Well, he's wrong. And who wrote this article? It just, oh, it makes me so incensed. I mean, how can we advance science if people writing books like this just reinforce it? So what will happen is a real dim-witted principal or whatever, head teacher will come to me and say, look, it's written like this in the book. Are you saying that this book is incorrect? And indeed, I do say so. Charles Babbage, sometimes called the irascible genius, Charles Babbage, 1791 to 1871, was a remarkable English mathematician whose idea of a mechanical calculus and thinking machines anticipated the computer age by 150 years. Charles Babbage, so the story goes, began his lifelong quest to create a mechanical calculator engine one evening in 1821. That night, the young Babbage and his friend John Herschel, superhero I love, so he just coins so many words with photography and the sun. I just loved it. I want to read about him. We're poring over the manuscripts of some mathematical tables they were preparing for the Astronomical Society, painstakingly checking tens of thousands of entries one by one. As they did, they came across an error after error made by computers. The poorly paid human calculators who worked out such figures. Finally, in exasperation, Babbage exclaimed, "I wish to God these calculations could be executed by steam." Babbage's frustration was simply not a mind-numbing and tedious work in the compiling tables, but the high chance of mistakes. Yet the timetables were vital in many spheres of life, science, taxation, engineering, surveying, insurance, banking, and more. When a ship set sail, for instance, the navigator's cabin was aligned with a volume after volume of tables to help him pinpoint the ship's position at sea. People have been using aids to calculations for thousands of years, tallies, sticks, abacuses, and others. And through the 17th and the 19th century, mathematicians such as Gottfried Leibniz and Bayes Pascal have created mechanical calculating aids. Some were devices were exquisitely ingenious, but were limited in scope and prone to error, both because they could give the wrong reading and because human input was needed at every step, each time with a risk of error. Babbage's idea was to calculate the new machine which worked completely automatically, and so do away with human error. He wasn't the first to think of the idea, but he was the first to try and make it practically a reality. Babbage's machine called the difference engines because it was cleverly allowed complex multiplication and divisions to be reduced to addition and subtractions or differences that could be handled in scores of interlocking cogs. Although the work of the difference engines was halted after 10 years when the government withdrew funding, Babbage was undeterred and threw himself into the development of a far more sophisticated machine named the analytical engine. The difference machine was essentially just a clever mechanical calculator, although it incorporated such sophisticated areas of automatic printing of results. But experts who have studied Babbage's papers believe the analytical engine could have truly being what we now call a computer, a machine that could think, responding to a new problem and devising its own way of solving them without human intervention. In working out his ideas for the analytical engine, Babbage anticipated virtually all the key design elements of the modern computer, including the central processing unit and different kinds of memory. I must admit, some of my father's memory, he was working in Australia's first computer, the fourth computer in the world, using little hand-me-downs from the US. So obviously, it's the fourth computer in the world, and then many other computers followed, and then the technology went, okay, let's go. Remarkably, Babbage's ideas were not just vague concepts, but thoroughly practical ideas were simply beyond the technology of the day to build. Later in life, Babbage designed a simpler version of the difference engine. His designs, drawing for difference engine number 2, were so thorough that in 1991, after In 150 years, the London Science Museum were able to use them to build a full-scale version and show it really worked. The chances are that the analytical engine would have worked too, but had it been built in the era of Charles Dickens, we would have had computers. Young Babbage, born in South London on Boxing Day 1791, Babbage was a child of a wealthy parents who could afford to have him educated in some of the best private schools. His relationship with his father was never a happy one. Babbage wrote that he had a temper most horrible which can be conceived. Babbage was left with an insecure, defensive streak, which was the plague of him all his life. By the age of 19, when he went to Cambridge University, he was starting to prove himself a brilliant mathematician. He upset the university authorities with a provocative final presentation. God is a material agent, which cost him the top honours and caused him to be barred from long-term thereafter from access to the academic post, which, of course, threw him into computing. It's pretty amazing how these things go. Putting this, I just want to think, it is interesting about Faraday and the mental stuff and people being pushed around and coming to the top. Putting a setback blithely behind him, Babbage married young Georgina Whitmore against his father's wishes and set up home in London, of course, as the father's going to hate him all the time. Fortunately, Babbage was likeable, talented, and energetic, and soon became a leading London in scientific circles, helping to found both the Royal Astronomical Society and the Analytical Society to promote the analytical calculus and statistics. Thus, when he applied for government funding to build the full-size version of the difference engine after a small-scale trial in 1821, he found he had plenty of influential friends and supporters willing to vouch for his credentials. Vive la difference! Difference engine number one was a tremendously ambitious project. No calculator had ever worked with numbers bigger than four digits. Babbage planned to build a machine that could handle numbers up to 50. Once set, it worked through the entire calculation automatically. To build it, Babbage hired Jervis, perhaps the best machinist in London, set up a special dustproof workshop and went on extensive research tour, often incognito around the mills and workshops of the north, to become familiar with the most advanced manufacturing techniques. Each number of the difference engine was represented by a column of cogwheels, in which cogwheel was marked with digits 0 to 9. The number was set by turning the cogwheels to the column to the to show the right digits on each. The working model had 7 number columns, each 16-digit cogwheels or digits. Altogether, the difference engine had 25,000 moving parts, and many of them had to be totally identical, or the machine would not work. No one had ever attempted to make a machine that needed so many parts of such precision. It pushed the machinist's skills to the limits. Like space programs today, the project had many technological spin-offs, not the least of which the Whitworth screw, developed 20 years later by Joseph Whitworth, one of the workers on the project. Whitworth screw is the first standard-style screw system that revolutionised engineering. I would actually say that they're still, the old people still have Whitworth. This is before the M3, M5, and M8, M10. The need to develop technology as he went along meant the progress was slow. After 10 years of intense effort, only half the parts had been made. In 1832, to show progress, Babbage had a small section of the engine assembled, which he would use to entertain people and convince them that the theory of a rational universe could spring surprises by operating according to the laws, which remained invisible until they were suddenly took effect. A crucial notion of the theory of evolution. Dear, my God. By this time, Babbage had not only put a great deal of work into the project, but also £6,000 of his own money. The government, meanwhile, spent £17,000, the price of 25 of the most advanced steam locomotives of the day. And we were beginning to get seriously frustrated by the apparent lack of progress. When dispute arose between Babbage and Clement over bills, the government decided to call a halt for the project. And this is the one thing you have to understand, is that you've got to... I've seen many projects where they've fallen out and the government's closed a lot of them down, both sides. They've closed two or three projects. The two projects are vying and then they start to bicker, and the professionalism of both is such that they lose it. Hard times. The 5 years prior to 1832 had been particularly difficult for Babbage. In 1827, his father died, followed by his son and his beloved wife, Georgina. The publication of a vocal attack on the clicky, moribund nature of scientific assertion had earned him the most powerful of enemies. The accusation that he was using the project to line his pocket hurt deeply. As the project ground to a halt, Babbage, for the first time in the decade, had time to reflect. And as he did so, he began to realise that he could go much further with the mechanical calculation. He started to work on a grand new idea, the analytical engine. Having finished the design of the analytical engine on the paper, with the government still refusing to resume funding for the difference engine, Babbage was at a standstill. He therefore turned constantly inventive mind to other ideas and every now and then accepted invitations to act as a consultant on other projects. The railway engineer Brunel, for instance, asked him to assess whether the broad gauge or narrow gauge was better. While working on the railway, Babbage invented a device for uncoupling carriages automatically in case of derailment, a cow catcher, and a kind of black box for quarter for trains. I do like that. Okay, the enchantress of numbers. The work on the analytical engine, though, was lonely. Babbage's ideas were little understood, let alone appreciated. So it was with gratitude in 1843 he gained a fan in the shape of a 27-year-old aristocrat, Ada Lovelace. Now, this is amazing. We do know about Ada Lovelace, daughter of the poet of Lord Byron. Ada was convinced by her mathematical prowess, writing to Babbage, that the more I study, the more insatiable I feel my genius for it to be. Babbage was flattered and called her enchantress of numbers. Ada decided to take over publishing Babbage's ideas and arranged for publication of an Italian pamphlet about the analytical engine, to which she added an extensive explanatory notes. One of the key ideas in Ada's notes is the notion that the engine might have far wider applications than purely mathematical ones. It's clear that she and Babbage foresaw the real scope of mechanical brains. Ada wrote, many persons imagine that because the engine is to give us results in a numerical indication, the nature of the process must consequently be analytical and numerical. This is an error. The engine can arrange and combine numerical quantities exactly as if they were letters or general symbols, ending all differences. Ada's plans for Babbage were tragically thwarted when she contracted cancer and died at the age of just 36. It seems likely, though, that many claims about her contribution to the analytical engine were exaggerated, since Babbage's conception was virtually complete by the time she made contact with him. Ironically, Ada's publishing of the ideas of the analytical engine may have helped her finally scupper the chances for further funding of the difference engines. It seemed to be the government that Babbage himself had rendered the difference engine obsolete, and the work on the analytical engine, as Prime Minister Robert Peel made clear in a stormy interview with Babbage at the close at which Babbage turned on his heel, saying indignantly, if those are your views, then I wish you good morning. Afterwards, Peel commented acidly that Babbage's machine should be used to calculate the time at which it would be ready of any use. Taking advantage of all his work, the analytical engine, Babbage came up with a much simpler, more elegant design for the difference engine, the design he called difference engine number 2, as the machine built by the plants in 1991 by Science Museum. Years of isolation. By the 1850s, the years of disappointment were beginning to tell. Babbage had made enemies of powerful people and conducted a bitter public feud with Sir George Airy of Airy Patents, the Astronomer Royal, and Airy's friend, the astronomer Reverend Richard Sheepshanks. It was Airy's condemnation of Babbage's work and finally prompted the government to stop funding. Babbage accused him of envy and malice. This feud, Sheepshanks, was even nastier. The Swedish Babbage. The Babbage, now at his 60, was beginning to lose heart. Then, in 54, a Swedish printer called Georg Schultz brought to London a rough and ready difference engine he developed himself, inspired by reading Babbage's 20 years earlier. Schultz had been worried how Babbage might react to the rival, but Babbage welcomed him with open arms, helping him find a context in London to promote it. It was Schultz who predicted in 1857, Babbage will then be known for a true years, namely the one of the benefactors of mankind, among the noblest and most ingenious sons of England. Yet Schultz's machines, like Babbage's, are no more than curiosity, since printed tables and human computers remain cheaper and more practical option. Babbage resumed work on the analytical engine, wrote an insightful papers on a huge range of scientific topics, including ciphers, codes, chess, clock, lockpicking, industrial economics, geology, submarines, and astronomy. Babbage was aging, and his nights beset by nightmares, hallucinations, and dreadful headaches. He was also plagued by street musicians outside his house, suffering an ear condition which could make playing extremely upsetting to him. dear, poor thing. In October 1871, he fell seriously ill on the 18th, with the organ players in the street playing as loud as ever. He died. Oh, gee, that's awful. Imagine the organ players. I sort of think whether Faraday was suffering strokes and dizziness, or it was strokes. It sounds very much like what I had with the heart stuff. Charles Darwin. So, 1809 to 1882. So that's 73. In the century, so a few ideas in history and science have so completely altered the way we see ourselves as Charles Darwin, 1809 to 82, theory that all life, including humans, evolved in the present form through a process of natural selection. The century before Darwin was born, scientific observation and the powerful rationality of the Age of Enlightenment were slowly changing the way people looked at the natural world. It was no longer considered quite so mysterious and magical, but something that could be catalogued, studied and probed with the help of the growing body of scientific knowledge. Throughout the later part of the 18th century, botanists had built on Linnaeus's work, discovering and classifying more and more species of plants around the world. To this extent, zoologists had done the same thing with animals. Great new botanical gardens, such as of Kew in London, the Zoological Gardens, are living testaments to the efforts of these species hunters. Both scientists and theologians began to ask just how all these species had come about, and why each of them seemed so perfectly suited to the environment in which they live, fish for swimming in seas, birds flying in the sky, and so on. The orthodox view was that of the creationists. According to the book of Genesis, the Bible, God created every living creature that moves, every winged fowl, and everything that creeps on the face of the earth. So creationists believe, as many still do, that every species is created at once by God. And this was perfectly designed by him suit the conditions in which it lived by him. In 1802, the theologian William Paley argued in favour of the original design idea with an example. If you found a watch in a desert, you would surely assume that it had been made by some skilled watchmaker. How much more skilled then was the watchmaker who fashioned the human eye? However, some thinkers were beginning to question the idea that all species had been there from the start, unchanging. More and more naturalists were looking at fossils and finding they were species that often seemed very different from those alive today. There had been species gone, and why were so few fossils of the creatures alive today? At the same time, geologists such as James Hutton were beginning to change the orthodox idea that the world was just a few thousand years old. And I think that Hutton was actually still referred to here. A growing minority were arguing the earth was in fact very old, and that the landscapes were created over long cycles of erosion and upheaval. Hutton did the boat saying, yeah, what goes on. Against this background, more and more thinkers began to argue species had not fixed but had actually changed or evolved throughout time. One of these thinkers was Charles Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin. Another, or perhaps more famous, was the French naturalist Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. I love the Lamarck book. I love it so much. And how Lamarck he was kicked out of a job just before the revolution. Lamarck not only developed a picture of how species progressed in a purposeful manner from a single cell organism to the supreme species, mankind, but also suggested just how this evolution takes place. He argued that each species has an inner feeling which propels it to ascend the ladder of evolution. He also argued that skills which aid survival can be passed on to the next generation and so gradually built up. A giraffe had stretched its neck to reach higher branches, for instance, would pass its long neck on to the offspring. Lamarck's ideas so shocked the orthodox religious views that those championing them were often vilified and sacked from teaching positions even as late as 1840. Many scientists, too, found the idea of inheriting acquired characteristics unconvincing, but Lamarck's system hardly began to explain how each species is so marvellously to its environment. Darwin's great breakthrough was not the discovery of evolution. Lamarck and others had done that. What he did was work out exactly what evolution is and how it happens. His insight was to focus on individuals, not the species, and showed how individuals evolve by natural selection. Natural variation in a group of individuals means that some will be better equipped to survive for particular conditions, and if they survive, they'll pass on the characteristics to their offsprings. Later commentators have characterized his idea of survival of the fittest, but it was never a phrase of Darwin himself used. Mechanism explained how all species, including humans, evolved to become well-suited to their environments. Young Darwin. Darwin was born on the 12th of February 1809 in Shrewsbury, the son of a well-to-do country doctor. Charles was the youngest of the family and the only boy, and throughout his childhood he devoted on by his sisters. He was educated by the local public school, but was too busy collecting natural specimens and conducting chemistry experiments to shine at class. The school, Darwin said, as a means of education, to me, was simply a blank. But at the age of 16, he went off to Edinburgh to study medicine like his father, but Darwin found all the operations far too gruesome and spent most of his time as a zoologist for Robert Grant, a great believer in Lamarck's ideas. Both were avid collectors and spent many days rambling the Scottish hills looking for plants. So, while Leonis was out collecting plants in Sweden, he was in Lapland. Since he was clearly not suited to study medicine, Darwin's father sent him off to Cambridge to study divinity at Christian's College. Here again, Darwin was instructed by another naturalist, this time Reverend Professor John Henslow, who energetically restored Cambridge's botanical gardens after years of neglect. As with Grant, the two of them formed a firm bond that would often go specimen hunting together. The trip of a lifetime. In 1930, Henslow was offered a post on the board HMS Beagle, soon due to set off to South America, the sailing ship of the Admiralty. Henslow was unable to go, but offered the job to young Darwin instead. At first, his father refused permission, but then he relented after strenuous efforts from his daughters. The Beagle's voyage was, quite literally, a trip of the lifetime, see box 94, page 94. Initially meant as 2 years, it actually lasted over five. But the time Darwin came back, he was a changed man. Not only had he gathered enough data about species around the world to last him a lifetime, but he'd learned enough by close observation of the extraordinary range of wildlife that he saw start sowing the seed of his theory of evolution. Nonetheless, Darwin was never a hasty man, and took him many years of patient thought and study before the theory was ready for publication. Fame and marriage. In the meantime, he found himself quite a celebrity when he returned to London, for Henslow had been giving lectures based on specimen notes had sent back while sailing around the world. He was appointed Fellow of the Geological Society, invited to join the exclusive gentlemen's club, the Athenaeum, and elected a Fellow of the Royal Society. Yet he was never one to seek the lion lap, and over the next years he spent much of his time quietly making notes and developing his ideas on these species questions, building up data, visiting zoos, taking plant breeders, naturalists, birders, anyone who might give him with more background information. Although he loved the quiet, studious life, he also began to feel the need for companionship, and in 1839, 29-year-old Darwin decided to marry his cousin Emma. Having carefully weighed the pros and cons, it proved to be a happy marriage, and the couple moved to a down house near Bromley in Kent, and remained there the rest of their lives. Darwin was never in robust health, and may have caught some tropical disease in the Beagle voyage, but he was well looked up at down house by Emma, who continued building up his ideas of evolution. The breakthrough. Although Darwin's ideas mostly grew by slow accumulation, there was a eureka moment when he read the essay On the Principle of Population by Thomas Malthus. In the essay written in 1798, Malthus had argued that populations, both human and animal, will always multiply until they exceed the food amount available, at which the population will crash, only for the process to start again. Darwin was excited. At once it struck me that under these circumstances, favourable variations would tend to be observed, favorable ones would be destroyed. The result would be the formation of new species. I had at last got the theory which would work. Yet, although he had the theory, he kept it very much to himself. Indeed, he soon embarked on 10 years of work writing a treatise on a single species of barnacle, which he described thus: Mr. Arthrobus is an enormously coiled penis. He might have carried on in this way if the bombshell had not dropped suddenly in his desk on September 1858. Dear. So, I don't know whatever that means. Okay, the arrival. The bombshell was a letter from Alfred Wallace, a young naturalist, when lying ill with malaria in Molucca Islands off Indonesia. Wallace obtained a theory of evolution by natural selection which corresponded almost exactly to Darwin's own. I never saw a more remarkable coincidence, Darwin later commented. Darwin talked to his friends, the famous geologist Charles Lyell and botanist Joseph Hookham and philosopher T.H. Huxley. And together they arranged for Darwin's and Wallace's ideas to be presented together, making it clear Darwin had developed his ideas 12 years previously. Spurred into action, Darwin then wrote his great book, The Origin of Species, in which he outlined the ideas and gave forth the supporting evidence gathered from the Beagle voyage and subsequent research. It was a sensation. The first edition, 1,225 copies, sold out the day of publication, 24th of November, 1859. Some of the people immediately embraced the idea, seeing how it explained the huge amount of amount about the natural world. Others condemned it as an affront to God, because nowhere did Darwin's idea leave room for biblical creation. Heated discussions began to take place around the dining tables of debating chambers across England. The most famous encounter between Darwin's friend T.H. Huxley and Bishop of Oxford, Soapy Sam Wilberforce. At one time of the debate, Wilberforce challenged Huxley to say whether it was on his grandfather's side or his grandmother's side that he was descended from an ape. But this was a cheap jibe, cost Wilberforce victory. Turning it neatly around, Huxley argued persuasively and seriously enough to carry the day. This was a picture across the country. The Darwinists, as they became called, gradually won more and more people to their cause. A major setback occurred in 1862 when the Scottish physicist William Thomson, later Lord Kelvin, estimated the age of the Earth scientifically. Kelvin declared the Earth could be no older than 40 million years old, now possibly only 20 million years old. His calculations were based on how long it would take the Earth's interior to cool down to its current temperature from the original molten state. This was a real blow, because Darwin's theory depended on the Earth being much older, but it turned out that Kelvin was mistaken, depending on the Earth being much colder. But it turned out that, Kelvin was mistaken on how fast the Earth is cooling. Further calculations show the world was over 4 billion years old. I think it's not calculations. I think you need radio dating, quite honestly. Human descent. In the meantime, Darwin, who kept quiet about the debate in Down House, wrote The Descent of Man, 1871, which explained how the theory of evolution applied the evolution of mankind and apes. In the famous passage, Darwin wrote, "Man, with all his noble qualities, still bears the bodily frame in disabled state of his lowly origin." Darwin went on developing his ideas, particularly in relation to humans, for the rest of his life. In 1872, aged 63, he published an important book on how emotions and expressions might be evolved, entitled Origins of Expressions of the Emotion in Man and Animals. By now, the long years of poor health and hard study were taking a toll. He died on the 9th of April, 1882, aged 73, and wildly mourned. He's buried in an honour at Westminster Abbey, his coffin carried, amongst other, by his friend and champion, T.H. Huxley. It's a picture of Galapagos Finch. The Voyage of the Beagle. Let's read about this. In his autobiography, Darwin wrote, "The Voyage of the Beagle has been far the most important event in my life and has determined my whole career." End quote. When Darwin embarked on the voyage, he was simply an amateur botanist with only the most basic knowledge of plants, very little zoology and no geology. As Darwin set sail, Henslow gave him a copy of the first volume of Lyell's newly published The Principles of Geology. It was a revelation to him, showing how landscapes have evolved gradually over long cycles of erosion and upheavals. At the Beagle's first stop in Cape Verde Islands, Darwin saw a seam of white coral running up the side of a volcano, showing that it had gradually been uplifted from the sea, not suddenly, as Cretaceous said. It was enough to convince him that Lyell's ideas were right. He wrote, "Geology carries the day." As the voyage continued down the coast of South America, Darwin gathered a huge number of specimens and took copious notes on the wildlife and other geological features that he encountered. With everything he saw, the idea of species were designed with a fixed once and for all, so increasingly unlikely to him. The culmination of his observations came in the Galapagos Islands off the coast of South America in autumn 1835. There were 20 or so islands there, And each one, Darwin noted, had its own subspecies of finch and its beak perfectly adapted to the way of feeding. I don't think he did it at the time. I think it was afterwards he got it. Some use their beaks for cracking nuts, others for sucking nectars of flowers and so on. And as Darwin said, one might really fancy that from the original paucity of birds on the archipelago, one species has been taken and modified to different ends. It was, for him, the clinching piece of evidence that the species evolved to suit the environment. They were not designed to suit it right from the start. By the time Darwin came home, obviously by Australia, just up the road here, he was firmly convinced of the reality of evolution. All he needed was to work out how and why it happened. That was his lifetime's work. Okay, 19th century, Louis Pasteur. See how you go on that one. It's 34 minutes coming together. I've got another 10 minutes of reading here. With his brilliant work on microbes, the great French scientist Pasteur, 1822-95, pioneered the theory that germs caused disease, discovered how to vaccinate against rabies, anthrax, and chickenpox, and found a method of treating wine, beer, and milk to prevent from spoiling that now bears his name. In the mid-19th century, although trains were speeding, people quickly from place to place, cell graphs were enabling instant communication. And scientists were discovering fields, radiation, subatomic particles, medicine was still comparatively in the dark ages. The chances of surviving childhood, even among the well-to-do, were not that good. Victorian families almost expected at least one of their children would die young, although that did not make it easier to bear. Women knew there was quite a high chance they would die giving birth, especially if they went to hospital. After a surgical operation, the chances were the diseases would kill the patients, even if the surgery did not. Diseases like cholera consumption, TB, took a high toll, especially amongst the poor. Doctors were virtually powerless against many illnesses. Catching diseases like consumption or syphilis was almost certainly a death sentence. Doctors had very few drugs we have taken today. Indeed, the only effective drug they had was opium to kill pain. They also had no idea what actually caused infectious disease. Leeuwenhoek, our microscope guy, had hinted at the possible role of microbes in disease and discovered them in the 17th century. But no one had really taken up the idea. In the 19th century, many doctors still believed diseases were caused by miasma, a mysterious toxic vapour that welled from stagnant waters, slums and faeces. Even though they had observed bacteria in wounds and diseased tissue, they believed these appeared spontaneously and were actually a natural result of the decaying process. Pasteur's initial interest in microbes came from his research into winemaking, which showed the microorganism called yeast were what made wines ferment and mature. So a yeast is a single-cell fungus. There you go. He discovered how wrong kind of microbes can make the wine go off, and that it could be eradicated by heat treatment. He then went on to prove that spontaneous generation, the idea that microbes appear from nothing, was a fallacy. Pasteur became convinced that germ microbes caused disease, which was an idea also suggested by the young German scientist Robert Koch. And Pasteur went on to show that many diseases could be prevented by arming the body's defences through vaccination, a weakened form of the germs. Over the next few decades, scientists succeeded in identifying germs responsible for a range of diseases, including TB, cholera, diphtheria, leprosy, tetanus, malaria, and yellow fever. The young artist Pasteur, born on the 27th of September 1822 in Dole, Boulogne, his father, Jean-Joseph, was a tanner and reasonably well off. As a boy, Louis had a more talent for art than science, and it was said that he would have been a great painter. However, as he grew older, he showed an increasing interest in science. When he was 21, he entered the prestigious École Normale Supérieure to train as a science teacher. So Priest was a science teacher, Boyle was a science teacher, he's a science teacher. A year after graduating, he presented his first paper to the Academy of Science. It was a brilliant debut, in which he explained how it is that crystals of tartaric acid, which are made when grapes ferment, crystals of racemic acid are chemically identical, but polarized light differently and have different properties. And this is a racemic thing is left hand, right hand. Pasteur showed the crystals were not actually identical, but perfect mirror images of each other. Such was the impact of Pasteur's paper that he was given the Legion d'Honneur, a French Order of Merit, by the French government, a gold medal by the English Royal Society. Pasteur later became to recognise as the founder of what is now known as stereochemistry. That's exactly right. I think my warfarin has a stereoisomer, and one is 10 times more potent than the other, but they can't do it, so they just give it into you. The workaholic professor. He was made professor of chemistry at the University of Strasbourg. Because of these honours, he married Marie Land. As he did throughout his life, he began to work extremely hard as a researcher. Later in life, Marie wrote to his daughter, "Your father, very busy as always, says little to me, sleeps little, and gets up at dawn. In a word, he continues the life that I began with him 20, 35 years ago today." In 1854, Pasteur made a head of science at the University of Lille. Because he believed teachers and industrious would not live in separate worlds, he began to make quite a name for himself in the city by organising classes of working men to tips of factories for science students. He encouraged, by this, the manager of a local vinegar factory approached him with a problem. The factory made vinegar out of beet juice, but the fermentation process often seemed to go wrong, spoiling the vinegar. Similarly, problems occurred in wine-making and beer-making. Discovering yeast. Previously, scientists had assumed fermentation was a chemical process. When Pasteur investigated with the aid of microscopes, he said the wine and beer age properly. They contain round microbes called yeast. It was these microbes Pasteur realized had made the alcohol in fermentation. He observed that wine would be containing long, narrow yeast cells when process went wrong. It was clear to him that there are two kinds of yeast involved, one that made alcohol and the other that made unwanted lactic acid. In the way he came to typifying his approach, Pasteur was not content with discovering the problem. He wanted to find a solution. He soon found that he could kill off harmful yeast while leaving the good yeast undamaged by heating the wine gently to 60 degrees C. Winemakers were the first skeptical of his findings. Were worried about affecting the heating would have on the flavour. But they soon won over the process of pasteurisation, which is now widely used in wine, beer and milk, and fruit juices safe to drink. Microbes in the air. Pasteur's work in yeast cell made him begin to wonder how such microbes appeared in the first place. He was convinced they were not spontaneously generated, as many people said. By a series of simple and ingenious experiments, he showed that the food goes off when it's in contact with ordinary air, but not when it's exposed under the air which has been heated. Heated to kill off microbes. He also demonstrated food did not go off quickly high up in the Alps where the air is thin. This proved that mold on bad food is not generated spontaneously by the food, but comes from spores in the air. And fewer spores than in the air, there's more slowly the food to go off. Pasteur was beginning to acquire a Mr. Fix-It reputation, and in 1865, he was asked to investigate a disease that were killing silkworms threatening the silk industry in southern France. Reluctant at first because he knew nothing about silkworm caterpillars, he finally agreed the problem as usual began. He quickly realised that the tiny parasite was cultivated and recommended a drastic solution, destroying all infested worms and mulberry trees and starting again. The silk makers took advice and the silk industry survived. His reputation was now so great that in 1867 Napoleon III had a special laboratory created for him to replace the Attic laboratory in the Colonel, which he had to enter on his knees. Unfortunately, he only enjoyed new space a year when a stroke left him permanently paralysed in the upper arm and leg. He was thereafter dependent on the laboratory assistant to perform even but the simplest work for him, microbes and disease. By now, Pasteur was becoming convinced of the role of microbes in infection. The English surgeon Joseph Lister had read Pasteur's work and realised that the surgical operations could be much, much safer if the wounds were cleaned and the rest is sterilised to destroy microbes. The death rates of operation began to drop once the antiseptic procedure was introduced. Lister recognised Pasteur's contribution, saying that Pasteur's 70th birthday celebrations, quote, "Truly there does not exist in the world an individual to whom medical science owes more than to you." Pasteur himself began to investigate the way diseases spread amongst humans and animals, and was sure germs played a part. In 1876, Robert Koch claimed to have detected germs that caused sheep and disease anthrax. Pasteur ran down the test and not only confirmed Scotch's finding but showed that the germs can survive for long periods and so on. Therefore, healthy sheep should easily pick up the disease from a field previously occupied by sick sheep. The power of inoculation. At first, Pasteur thought to treat the problem he had, as he had in the silk worm infestation, by killing the infected sheep and burning the lamb. He then realized that any sheep survived a bout of anthrax became immune to disease. A century later, Edward Jenner, earlier, had shown that inoculating people with cowpox, a mild version of the smallpox disease, particularly against smallpox. Pasteur wondered if that might work with anthrax. In a famous experiment, he showed that sheep inoculated with anthrax germs weakened by killing and heating and survived inoculation with full street germs, while untreated sheep did not. In this way, millions of sheep were protected against anthrax. In 1878, Pasteur showed that inoculation worked on chicken cholera too. Soon, Pasteur turned his attention to rabies. His success in creating a vaccine against the terrible disease made him famous across Europe. Indeed, it caught the public imagination and the movement to collect funds and further his work to contributions are flooding in from far and wide, from both ordinary and people and royalty, including the Tsar of Russia. Over 2 million francs was raised, and on the 14th of November 1888, the Pasteur Institute was opened in Paris. Pasteur died on the 20th of December 1895 with the words, one must work, I have done what I could. He was given a full state funeral, burned in a magnificent tomb in the Pasteur Institute, its walls decorated with paintings of lambs, dogs and children whose lives had been saved. Isn't that beautiful? Lambs, dogs, thing. Preventing rabies. In the 1880s, rabies was a particularly nasty major disease that killed its victims slowly and agonizing, and Pasteur was determined to find a way to beat it. At risk to his life, he took samples from the jaws of rabid dogs by sucking the saliva through a glass tube and infected rabbits with them. In this way, he created a weakened version of the virus by drying out the rabbit's spinal cords after they died. When the weakened virus was injected to healthy rabbits, it infected them from rabies. Pasteur was unsure whether the vaccine would work on humans and was wary of trying. Then, in 1885, a 9-year-old shepherd called Joseph Mestier was brought to him after being bitten 14 times by a rabid dog. If Pasteur did nothing, the boy would certainly die in agony. 14 times. So he took the chance and injected the boy with his rabies vaccine. Fortunately, the treatment worked and the boy remained healthy. As the new Pasteur's success spread throughout Europe, he found people turning to him for a cure. Before long, a party of 19 Russians who had been bitten by a mad wolf turned up at his doorstep. It was 2 weeks since they'd been bitten, and Pasteur feared the disease might have gone too far. Again, his vaccine worked, and 16 survived. Over the next 10 years, 20,000 rabies victims were given to Professor's treatment, and only 200 died. So that's the end of that story, and I'll stop there.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.